Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet, online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Pamulaner. Over the last week, an alleged rape case in Maryville, Missouri has attracted national attention and fostered many public discussions about the way the public and the judicial system handles the aftermath of such allegations. In Maryville, charges against two high school boys had been dropped, but after the uproar prompted by articles by KCUR and the Kansas City Star, a special prosecutor will be appointed to handle the case. But some in the Maryville community have also been a focus of the discussion, as the then 14-year-old victim and her family say they eventually moved away from the community because of bullying and threats after the alleged rape occurred in January 2012. Today on Intersection, rather than focus on the details of that specific incident, we plan to discuss the issues cases like these bring up. What are the challenges in cases like these for the survivors and the justice system? And what is behind the victim blaming that occurs in some of these situations? Joining us in studio today, Zach Wilson is the development director at the Missouri Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. His organization does research and provides education and assistance to individuals and organizations fighting domestic and sexual violence. Zach, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me here.
Sure. Mary Beck is the director of the MU Domestic Violence Clinic. She's also a clinical professor of law at the University of Missouri. Mary, thanks for being here.
Thank you for asking me.
Sure. And joining us by Skype is Samantha Sunny. She's a former reporter at the Columbia Missourian, and she recently published a story about how the university and local law enforcement handle sexual assault cases, specifically among the college student population. We'll be talking a lot about that situation and what she found today on the show. Samantha, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure. And for you and our audience, what do you want to talk about in the wake of this high-profile Missouri case? Share your thoughts by giving us a call at 573-882-8925 or emailing intersection@kbia.org. You can also tweet us at intersectkbia. This is a live show, so as always, we're not sure exactly what will be said, but considering the specific topic on this week's show, we recommend you decide whether or not the content is appropriate for you, especially if you have children with you. So to start off, Sammy, maybe it'd be great to start with you and a little bit about your reporting. What were some of the key findings in your story that came out about a month ago now?
Well, so I was focusing on the student conduct process at the University of Missouri. My original goal was to find out what sanctions or punishments the university was handing out for sexual assaults or sex offenses in general. And I quickly realized that the university was not going to tell me what sanctions they were handing out for which offenses. It is public record if a university student is found responsible for an offense like this. The sanction that they're given and the violation they committed is public record, but the university declined to give me that information. But what I did find out was that only two reports even made it to the student conduct office in the year I was looking at, which was 2012. And two is an extraordinarily low number. I mean, we all know that there were actually probably thousands of incidents. And when I say incidents, I mean any sort of sex offense. So not necessarily sexual assaults, but any non-consensual sexual behavior. So the story turned into more about how only two victims actually reported to the Office of Student Conduct and all of the various reasons that could have kept them from reporting.
Right. And Sammy, or I'm sure anyone at this table could talk about, what are some of those reasons? Why are people not reporting? What are some of the obstacles there?
I think a primary obstacle, and we'll see that across the board, even in nationwide statistics. If you look at it, 54% of rapes go unreported. So you're seeing things on college campuses that you also see reflected in our larger society. And a lot of that is back towards the victim blaming portion of it. I mean, historically, that's been the problem that we've had with sexual assault prevention. We've always kind of laid that on the forefront of the victim's responsibility. Don't be in certain places. Don't go certain ways. Instead of really switching that over towards what allows perpetrators to do these kinds of behaviors. And so whenever we're looking at risk reduction as the way for prevention, if a sexual assault occurs, then there must have been a breakdown in one of those risk protective factors. And that then is the victim's fault, instead of really looking at where the blame lies on the perpetrator.
And Sammy, what else did you find in your reporting?
Yeah, I think in my mind, the many different reasons for victims to not report are separated into emotional reasons, legal reasons, social reasons. And some of those are unique to college campuses, not necessarily unique to the University of Missouri. In fact, they're replicated on all sorts of universities and colleges and other institutions and places. But there are a lot of emotional reasons, like, for instance, that the victim probably knows the suspect or the perpetrator. There are also a lot of legal reasons, like legal technicalities and, you know, for example, the definition of rape and things like that. So there are a lot. And actually, one of the things I struggled with in writing my story was how to sort of summarize all of these different reasons, because they can vary so widely and victims' reactions can vary so widely.
Yeah. And I guess here at the table, how does that environment here in a college campus, I guess, highlight some of these things? As Sammy said, they're not necessarily specific campus problems, right? But they're, you know, you're so close to someone, you likely know the person. That's pretty common for any sexual assault victim.
Yes. And the involvement of alcohol in sexual assault is such that the report made by a victim, if she has been or he has been using alcohol, then the blame somehow seems to shift to the victim rather than, as you said, staying with the perpetrator. And then the emotional reasons that Sammy talked about are huge, because there's a lot of implications for a victim. There's a culture of harassment that accompanies making such an allegation. So all of the perpetrator's friends or teammates or whatever may undertake to harass the victim. That's what happened in Maryville. That poor girl and her family ultimately moved out of town. So there's a number of factors there. There's a perpetrator with a sense of entitlement. There's a victim. There's a community of people in town or teammates or a fraternity who will undertake to harass the victim. There's alcohol. And then there's typically adults who are willing to cover up. And you put all those together and it's a perfect storm, and it is almost insurmountable for victims, which is reflected in the incredibly low reporting here at the university. I mean, if one out of four college girls is sexually assaulted, and what do we have, 35,000 students? Mm-hmm. We had two reports. That's just absurd. And it's not because the university doesn't have procedures in place to try to address the violence. It's just bigger than what the university can handle in response to violence. I think the only answer here is prevention, or greater attempts at prevention.
I couldn't agree with you more. Sorry. I mean, especially, I think that Samantha and Mary both definitely hit it right on the head when they talk about the multiple barriers that are there, from legal technicalities towards the cultural pressures of people harassing. Even just, you know, talking about healthy sexuality is a taboo topic in our culture. So if you're going to talk about abnormal sexuality, that it even comes to horse. So there's shame that's involved with it, and all those different things. And it goes back to exactly what you're talking about. It goes back to prevention. And for that really to occur, it has to be shifting social norms. It really has to be, because if we had a culture, especially if you look at a smaller insular culture like a campus, that did not accept anything on the continuum of sexual assault, from harassment all the way to rape, I mean, everything that was there, then all those other barriers that would be easier to overcome. I mean, we're not going to remove all the legal technicalities out there. We're not going to remove different things that are there. We can lessen those, but really with the support, that's really when victims can move forward and do the things that they need to do, knowing that they have the support of the peers that are around them, the institutions that are there, and also the legal system. I mean, that is a major component. We really have to look at how that's done. That's why we're really happy that we were able to get major revisions to Missouri sexual assault laws. We had some excellent support in the House and the Senate. Representative Jay Barnes was a great ally for us in getting those changed and really looking at the specific alcohol-related factors that mm-hmm. you were talking about. It used to be that incapacity or incapability to provide consent wasn't looked at when it came to our rape laws. That's in there now. So it used to be the perpetrator had to drug someone, basically, and it wasn't that you were out yourself having a good time and got too inebriated to actually provide consent. That removed that from our rape laws and really was in lesser charges, but that's changed. So we're getting some systematic changes, but the cultural changes, not only people not accepting this, but also bystanders getting involved. That's where prevention really is, changing those social norms and bystanders intervening on what needs to be done.
I want to take a moment to remind our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're discussing the challenges in sexual assault cases for the survivors and for the justice system. Joining us in studio are Zach Wilson with the Missouri Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, and Mary Beck, the director of the MU Domestic Violence Clinic and a clinical professor of law. And joining us by Skype is Samantha Sunny. She's a former reporter at the Columbia Missourian, and she recently published a story about how the university and local law enforcement handle sexual assault cases, specifically among the college student population. And for you in our audience, what are your reactions to what Samantha found in her reporting? We'd like to hear what you think. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You can also tweet us at @intersectkbia. We'd like to remind you that you can watch Intersection as streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. And Zach, one more time, I want to go back to the, you mentioned that legal code change. So did that just go into effect? So have we seen, so really that will mean a shift in the way that some of these cases are prosecuted.
Ideally, right? Yes. It definitely provides that capability there. But as we've seen in Maryville, there is a lot of discretion with what prosecutors do and do not charge. So it really does go back to what is accepted, what voters push for in their communities, really everyone getting involved and supporting that rape and sexual assault does not occur in our community. But now those mechanisms are in place, and that's really good. And there's a lot of changes that were in there to make it much clearer. It did get a little confusing. There's, legislation gets built piece by piece. Sometimes you need to go in and kind of get an overhaul and get things all straightened up and where they need to be. And luckily we had the support this year in both the House and the Senate. So it was fantastic. It was great work that MCADSV did this year with the collective support of all of our member programs.
And Samantha, real quick, I wanted to help me clarify something on, we were talking about the fact that two of the assaults last year resulted in punishment for students. But can you help clarify some of those numbers, too? I know a lot of your reporting had to do with figuring out those numbers. Can you help us understand what that means and what all the other numbers were as far as reports that may have been from campus, I guess?
Yeah, so people tend to assume that those two reports concern sexual assaults. And considering that the students were suspended and expelled for them, they very well might have been sexual assaults. But in fact, the university declined to tell me what the violations were. So it might have been anything from a sexual harassment charge to indecent exposure to anything like that. And it's a very, very long time to get that information from the university. There are agencies like the MSP Center, which is a campus, sex offense survivors, and the police agencies were a bit more their data. But part of it was because the record keeping was problematic at the MU Office of Student Conduct, and they were also very resistant to talking to me about this story, like to give me information and to discuss it. I think it's a very taboo topic, like we've said, and everyone's trying very hard to put their best foot forward and do the best job they can. But then that also, I think, ends up in people being recalcitrant and withholding information that they really shouldn't.
Well, I think some of your reporting too had to do with the communication between the university and other legal entities. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, one thing that surprised me was the lack of communication, I'll say, between places like the RSVP Center, MU Police, the Columbia Police Department, the Office of Student Conduct, Office of Residential Life, places like that. I guess I always imagined that if, you know, for example, the media, if the Columbia, Missourian reported a rape on campus, then the Office of Student Conduct would do something about it. But they don't actually investigate cases unless someone comes and submits a report to them. So last year, only two victims actually came forward to them and submitted reports. The police don't necessarily feel any obligation to notify Student Conduct that an incident has occurred, although Student Conduct can ask police about that. There was also a law that surprised me, which is a good example of legal technicalities, where Missouri's public records law actually states that the names of sex victims are not public. So you can get a police report for a sex offense, but you can't get the name of the victim, which is a well-meaning law, certainly. But it also results in the police not being able to tell Student Conduct who a victim was in a certain incident. And if Student Conduct doesn't know who the victim is, then they have absolutely no way of investigating, or even if knowing if the victim is a student, because the victim has to be a student for the case to even fall within their jurisdiction. So it's not, I'm not saying that the agencies weren't speaking at all, but they certainly were not speaking to each other very much. And there were actually legal barriers to them speaking to each other about sexual cases in particular.
Mm-hmm. And Mary and Zach, I mean, in a situation where it's already difficult to get accurate reports from victims, how much more difficult are there these laws that kind of, I mean, there's this law and others that may, you know, have other intentions and have important meanings, but also, you know, make that process harder, I guess.
Well, the object is to protect the privacy of the victim and also to put her or him in control of the process. And many times the victims do not want an investigation by Student Conduct or by the police on campus or in town. So the victim is really in charge of that.
Mm-hmm. And so how does that conversation usually go? I mean, again, there's so many factors involved in that, right? But, you know, how much of it is making sure they're in control, but also saying, you know, there something needs to happen here. You know what I mean? It's tough, right?
The university has procedures to make sure that victims are notified of their options, mm-hmm. but there's never certainly any pressure placed on them to take advantage of those options. And we've already discussed all the reasons why victims mm-hmm. don't like to report. They don't want their victimization to be made public, to be open to ridicule, to be open to blame, to get harassed. There's just a lot of factors working against the disclosure by the victim.
Yeah, and I think that that's definitely true. There's also ways, though, that we can work around some of these issues while protecting confidentiality. And that's really where the development of sexual response teams, really looking at sexual assault response teams and really looking at, like, coordinated efforts that the community can get around. And those are times where a lot of trends and a lot of cases, without going into specifics, those entities can work with each other. So maybe we don't have the specific hard data, but we understand the overall scope. And then whenever the nonprofit sector and whenever the campus sector and the police sector and those groups are coming together and having those coordinated meetings where they're really working together, good things can come out of that, as well as an understanding that everyone will handle this situation correctly. That will then move out in almost a ripple effect into the population, where then people know that there's these institutions that care. And so it makes it more likely, yes, I will report this. Yes, I will take that next step, because they know that they'll be protected throughout the whole way. Unfortunately, a lot of that work is stuff that isn't on anyone's calendar, right? I mean, people are there to do it. Nonprofits are really trying to push it. Our member programs, RSVP is one of our member programs of the coalition. They're really trying to push those kinds of efforts moving forward. Unfortunately, the funding isn't there to support nonprofits in that work. We don't have any state dollars to respond to sexual assaults in our communities. We don't have this kind of coordinated community efforts that can support that. So that's really where the nonprofits and these groups rely on community support to get involved, to move forward. And then anyone that wants to learn how they can get involved to kind of support these efforts are free to contact our organization, MCADSV. You can go to our website. You can do those different kinds of things and be figure out how to get involved.
I want to take a moment to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuelner, and today we're discussing the challenges in sexual assault cases for the survivors and for the justice system. Joining us in studio are Zach Wilson with the Missouri Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence and Mary Beck, the director of the MU Domestic Violence Clinic and a clinical professor of law. And joining us by Skype is Samantha Sunny. She's a former reporter at the Columbia Missourian, and she recently published a story about how the university and local law enforcement handle sexual assault cases, specifically among the college student population. We'd also like to hear from you in our audience. Do you know someone who has been affected by sexual assault or domestic violence? What services or support systems did they need during that time? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. Mary, maybe you can help us with this too. So, again, it's a very big decision, and many times for victims it's going to be difficult to know what the right route is. But how important is the timing in putting together a successful case? I guess the speed of putting a case, of making that decision, I guess. It's got to be a tough thing from a prosecutorial standpoint.
If you're talking about prosecution, then timing is critical. For one thing, if a victim delays reporting the rape, somehow that seems to suggest that it's not credible. If the victim was drinking, that suggests that it wasn't critical. And so a lot of victims will wake up, realize that they've been a victim of sexual assault, hop in the shower, be very sad, worrisome, call friends, and all of that results in a delay. It also results in destroying the evidence because if, for example, a man or woman's been raped, there are rape tests that can be done that would identify the perpetrator. Keep in mind that many victims don't know who actually raped them, but the rape kits would identify the rapist through DNA testing. But if a victim showers, bathes, delays, gets sober, checks with his or her friends, all of that works to destroy the prosecutor's evidence and ability to go forward with the prosecution.
Right. And again, many times it's not going to be a quick decision, right? To not just on the gathering of evidence, but like you said, delays are a problem too.
That's right.
I guess,
and you can imagine how traumatic it would be to be raped. And then, you know, here I am saying we've got to hurry up and get this reported. It's a very traumatic thing to have happen, and speeding around to get it reported is not the first thing that comes to a victim's mind.
Yeah, and I was saying, and that's one of the reasons why I think the work that the rape crisis centers in communities, often it's also the domestic violence shelters, because they may be the only ones there that can respond, depending on the community that you're in, where they can really play that critical role where a rape crisis advocate can really get there and talk to an individual. A lot of the times that happens at a hospital, and so when victims have already made that decision to get to the hospital, but they can help them walk through what their options are. And I just wanted to make sure that if anyone's out there right now who is a survivor, whether it happened a day ago or whether it happened 2 years ago, there's services that are available for you. You can visit our website at www.mocadsv.org, and we have a breakdown of any community, any kind of services you want, so you can see a service provider. Also, you can give our organization a call, and we can help walk you through that process as well, too. And we can be reached at 573-634-4161. So that's really ways that people can get involved, or if you just want to educate yourself and what you can do, those are also contacts that you can use. And then we can help connect you to a local program where you can go down there and volunteer, or you can become a member of MCADSV so that you can then have your voice heard on the state level and what you different ways that you can do. So I really, if you don't think this is something that's affecting you right now, the numbers bear out that it's going to affect someone in your life, maybe you. I mean, it's there. So learning and educating about it is a first step towards really changing some of our behaviors that are around that. So I really tell people, reach out, see what's going on in your community, see what's going on in the state.
Sure. That's where I think the university needs to move to. Was it a couple of years ago that every staff and faculty member at the university had to complete online sexual harassment training? Mm-hmm. Obviously, the university wants to protect its faculty and staff, or they wouldn't have done that. And I think the time is now to start mandating completion of an online domestic and sexual assault training and alcohol training for all students. It's cheap. It's online. It takes the student 35 minutes, and it's the difference of a lifetime if they learn to protect themselves or to recognize what constitutes domestic or sexual assault. Huge difference.
And what do they learn in those trainings for someone who hasn't ever had that training?
Well, like, amazingly, a lot of men really don't understand that if a woman is unconscious, she can't give consent. Now, I know you two think that's obvious, but I've had young men in my office who say, well, she didn't resist. Was she conscious? Well, no, she was passed out, but she didn't say no. I would never rape anyone. If they're unconscious, they can't consent. A lot of men don't know that. And girls, a lot of girls don't know. Do not take a drink once you have put it down. If you have put your drink down and walked away from it, don't ever pick it up again. Go get a fresh drink. I don't care what it costs. Your mom, your dad, your brother, or your sister will pay you for a fresh drink. Don't ever pick it up. Don't go somewhere without friends. And usually rapes occur in the first week or two of classes. And so if the university were committed to requiring the completion of online training for every man and woman who enrolls at the university, I think it would make far more difference than all of these post-assault efforts that we're making so earnestly to try to help.
Is college level early enough?
No.
Did it happen earlier?
No,
than that?
Definitely yeah. not.
I agree with you 100% with what you're talking about. It really is. And those conversations, historically, it goes back to what I was talking about previously. Historically, those conversations have been been had with women in our society. People do talk more often, moms talking to daughters about, you know, don't walk home at night by yourself. Don't do this. Don't, if you have a drink. I mean, that those kinds of messages have been historically getting out there. And that's one of those things that why critical needs to occur puts all the responsibility on the victim to make sure that you're staying safe. But unfortunately, we're not seeing the other side of it, of fathers talking to sons or of mothers talking to sons, because people don't want to see their son as a perpetrator. That's my precious little boy. I'll tell you right now, I'm a father of three boys. I've got an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old, and a 9-month-old. And they're the best little boys in the world. Sorry for anyone else that has kids out there. But I'm going to have that conversation with my sons and specifically saying, no, I'm not going to sit there and say, don't be a rapist. I may get that at some point. But I'm going to talk about what it is, what consent is, but also how to treat women, how to be respectful, how not to try to exhibit power over someone. Because really, when you're looking at rape,
that's right.
It's exerting power over someone. So if you start talking to your sons about that, that's getting in front of the issue. That doesn't get the campus off the hook either. I agree with you 100%. Mm-hmm. There needs to be comprehensive sexual assault prevention going on campuses. But it needs to happen earlier.
And when we, in high school.
I'll be able to talk about it a little bit later in our program, but we have a great program that Missouri is the first in the nation of piling out in middle schools, a middle school sexual assault prevention program, and that's fantastic.
Yeah, I hate to interrupt it. We will have to take a short break, though. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're discussing the challenges in sexual assault cases for the survivors and the justice system. Joining us in studio are Zach Wilson, Mary Beck, and Samantha Sunny is joining us via Skype. I'm Ryan Fielner. We'll be right back after a short break. Welcome back to Intersection. This is a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're discussing the challenges in sexual assault cases for the survivors and the justice system. Joining us in studio are Zach Wilson with the Missouri Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence and Mary Beck, the director of the MU Domestic Violence Clinic and a clinical professor of law. And joining us by Skype is Samantha Sunny. She's a former reporter at the Columbia Missourian, and she recently published a story about how the university and local law enforcement handle sexual assault cases, specifically among the college student population. And for those of you in our audience, do you know someone who's been affected by sexual assault or domestic violence? What services or support systems did they need during that time? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You can also tweet us at intersectkbia or join our online chat. This is a live show, so as always, we're not exactly sure what will be said, but considering the specific topic of this week's show, we recommend you decide whether or not the content's appropriate for you, especially if you have children with you. And there in the break, I may just have you guys rekindle that conversation you were having about Zach and Mary, about getting to these children, frankly, at middle school, high school age. What are some of the methods used in the state and in other places, I guess, that seem to have some success at this point?
Well, I mean, there's always age-appropriate conversations you can have with your kids. I mean, that prevention message was loud in the 80s and 90s when it came to sexually transmitted diseases. I mean, and so people have started, okay, let's have questions about healthy sexuality earlier. But we can also look on the other side of it as well, too. But then it's also looking at the continuum of what sexual assault really is, from harassment, from making those jokes, those demeaning statements, to making someone less than you. And you can have those conversations at middle school. You can have those conversations in elementary school. So we're seeing some great stuff around the nation at the college level. There's a great model out there, the Green Dot model, and it's really about how bystanders can intervene and help redirect things that are going on. Mizzou, I'm pretty positive, has that program going on. So what we did is we worked with those national curriculum experts and adapted that curriculum and put it at the middle school level. And so now we're really excited about our middle school community mobilization program that's being piloted out in middle schools that we want to be able to take out across the state to start having these conversations earlier, because schools are requiring anti-bullying and prevention. That message can go in there. So we've got a great partnership with the Department of Health and Senior Services with their contract to help push those efforts forward. But in order for those programs to move forward inside of a community, those local member programs also need the communities. Those member programs need the community support. So it's really about how then those communities can come together.
Okay. Well, one thing we've talked a lot about throughout the show, but maybe it might be good to focus on a little bit more, is the idea of victim blaming and what some of the root causes are of that. We've touched on a few things, but at its most basic level, why is that something that happens? I mean, it seems so counterintuitive, right? You've talked, Mary, a little bit earlier about how sometimes it may be a group mentality, right? Especially around, we see a lot in these high-profile cases around sports athletes and things like that, where they have this support system already built up around them. But I don't. What are some of the other root causes of this, I guess?
Well, sexual assault is part of domestic assault, and we have for many years been blaming the victim for interpersonal violence. Like, why didn't she just leave? Like, she's supposed to leave her home instead of putting the blame on the person who assaults, and putting the responsibility on the community to respond appropriately to the perpetrator. But instead, we have for generations been blaming the victim. I think it's an extension of that with sexual assault, and probably more intense because sex and women were supposed to not go together until later when they got married, but sex and men was acceptable anytime. And so those stereotypes are really hard to die off.
And Samantha, I know this came up briefly in your reporting as well. What did you find here locally?
Well, there are a lot of different reasons. One thing that I think Zach already mentioned was that mothers don't want to see their sons as rapists. And I mean, nobody wants to see anybody know as a rapist. And given that victims in almost all cases know the perpetrator, their friends, their family members, or at least a I think rape is such a harsh word, or sexual assault is such a harsh and legal term, that they don't want to apply it to themselves or to their perpetrator. I think on a college campus, alcohol is certainly a big factor, like Mary mentioned. I read one report by an association of prosecutors that said that in cases that involve alcohol, the victim was far less likely to even identify the incident as rape. And then that also gets combined with people who, you know, blame her for being drunk in the first place, for not just getting up and leaving. There are also very few other witnesses often, and it'll just come down to what the victim says versus what the alleged perpetrator says. And unfortunately, often people are inclined to believe the alleged perpetrator over the alleged victim.
Right. And when we went into the break, Mary, you were talking about some of the things you teach your children about being safe in these situations. But what's the balance between teaching these safe behaviors and avoiding that culture of victim blaming? I mean, specifically with drinking, right? I mean, it is a smart thing to be smart, you know, tell your children to be smart about drinking, but at the same time, it kind of comes at the cost of that idea of victim blaming, right?
True.
Yeah.
If you're only doing the one thing.
Right.
If our culture is also talking to the men out there on not taking advantage of those situations, understanding that that is fine. Someone is allowed to go out and have a good time and drink. And that doesn't mean they're consenting to sexual activity. It doesn't even mean if you're a boyfriend and a girlfriend and you've had sex in the past and you went out and had a drink, that that implies it's okay because we've already had sexual intercourse before, or an ex-boyfriend, ex-girlfriend. So if we're not having those conversations on both sides, then it's skewed. And then we're only looking at where did this fall off. But we have those same conversations with people when we say lock your cars at night when you're in a certain place. Make sure that you take care of this whenever you're parking. But if someone has their car stolen, we don't blame them. I mean, if they left their keys in the ignition and did different stuff, you may say, but we still look at the criminal that's behind it. You know, they still may say, well, you can do something different in the past, but the blame still falls on the perpetrator. We are so skewed and imbalanced because we don't have that secondary conversation. And that should be the primary conversation. Both, everybody, women and men, should both be having these conversations with their children, and so that they can continue and move forward, and that we change what society really looks like and what it is.
Right, right. Mary, any thoughts on all that?
I agree with everything said. I don't know what else I can add.
Okay. How much of is this victim blaming really, and the people that you've dealt with in some of these situations, is that often one of the main concerns, is I don't want
Absolutely.
This retribution? Yeah.
Yes, I've had those young women in my office, and they're just horribly ashamed, embarrassed. One of their primary goals is to keep it a secret, and leaving school is one of the first options they consider. There's no question that the victim feeling guilty or harassed or embarrassed is a major motivating factor, certainly in the underreporting that Sammy was describing.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and Sammy, I had wrote down some of the numbers that you from your reporting. You looked at the Boone County prosecutor saying that there were 81 cases, and only 36 of those ended up bringing charges. 20 of those ended with convictions. Can you tell us a little about those numbers and what you found out about how that process usually goes?
Right. I spent a long time talking to a representative of an organization called Equitas, which is a legal organization that helps lawyers prepare cases of violence against women. And one interesting opinion that she had was that prosecutors should actually go forward with these kind of cases, even if they're not at all sure that they're going to win a conviction. And that's a very odd thing for a prosecutor to do. I think you'll find few prosecutors who are willing to do that because, I mean, ethically, they don't want to file charges against a person if they don't think they're guilty, but also they don't want to take a case to court that they don't think they're going to win. On the other hand, in so many of these cases, there actually is a small chance of conviction because of the standard of evidence required, which is you have to prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that for this man did rape this woman. And like I've said before, there are often no witnesses. Physical evidence is sometimes hard to come by. The victim's behavior can often seem very odd to the jury, like she might continue seeing this person or being friends with this person. So that's often a very difficult case to prove in a criminal court. One good thing about the student conduct process, at least in this context, is that Donnell Young, the director of student conduct at the time I was doing the article, he only needs a preponderance of evidence to find an accused student responsible for the offense. So that means he needs to be essentially 51% sure that this person had committed the offense, rather than beyond a reasonable doubt, which is something like 98% sure or something like that. So with the Boone County Prosecutor's Office, the numbers that you cited, they filed charges against a bit more than a third of the cases that they got. And then they did obtain convictions in, I think, 20 of those 36 cases. So that is, I think, a pretty good conviction rate, but it also probably means that there were a lot of cases that were not deemed evidence heavy enough to take all the way to court, or were probably reported to police and then never even made it to the prosecutor's office, because victims and other people report to police. And then if police decide there's a reasonable case, then they take it to the prosecutor's office. So there's kind of a narrowing down process that, you know, is a very valid and very good judicial system, but because of the complications in these cases, is a large part of the problem of why so few rape cases result in actual convictions.
Right. And Mary, I'll maybe give you a moment to respond, as the lawyer at the table, to respond to some of what Sammy just said.
Yes, you talked about an organization urging the filing of criminal charges against alleged rapists. A prosecutor has, like you said, an ethical duty to only file cases in which, and I don't remember the exact words of the standard, but to only file criminal charges in cases where they feel they have the evidence to convict. And so they're not going to file charges to make a public or social statement. They can get disbarred for that. So that's not an option. And we have the problem of victims recanting or victims refusing to testify in domestic violence as well as sexual assault cases. And it really does complicate the prosecutor's job tremendously. In domestic violence, we have evidence-based prosecution. So a lot of prosecutors will go forward without the victim. I don't know whether prosecutors will go forward if the victim of sexual assault is not testifying.
Well, that's because that's a key piece of evidence, correct? Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes there will be physical evidence, but a lot of times that's one of the key pieces, correct?
Right.
Yeah. And so
very true. I just wanted to talk about that as well, because I think that's part speaks to the Maryville case. And I think that why it's true that those victim testimonies are important in a prospect in a prosecutor's view of what needs to be moved forward with the case. They can move forward with a case without that. It does make it more difficult, but there can be evidence there, especially whenever a victim has already gone through the secondary trauma of going out and having a rape kit done and had that evidence collected. Mm-hmm. When that evidence comes into play, that really lessens the need for a victim to step forward and go through it over and over and over again. And that is part of the process as well of why people recant, because it becomes so emotionally overwhelming. You just can't do it again. You suffer the trauma again and again and again. So when we have that evidence there, prosecutors, I think, need to be willing to move forward if they feel they can convict even without that victim's testimony. We can also have all the other gambit of things in play that support a victim through that whole process. And so that's where rape crisis centers really come into play, of having a court advocate that can move forward with them and support that victim. Mm-hmm. But then it also goes back to what we're looking at with family, peers, and the community around you. And are you supporting the victims of rape? Or are you pushing them off into a corner and making them think that you stay there with your shame and don't come forward? And so we really have to see how we as an entire society can help people through that process.
I want to take a moment to remind our audience that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're discussing the challenges in sexual assault cases for the survivors and for the justice system. Joining us in studio are Zach Wilson with the Missouri Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, and Mary Beck, the director of the MU Domestic Violence Clinic and a clinical professor of law. And joining us by Skype is Samantha Sunny. She's a former reporter at the Columbia Missourian, and she recently published a story about how the university and local law enforcement handle sexual assault cases, specifically among the college student population. For you and our audience, what do you think contributes to the phenomenon of victim blaming, which has occurred in some high-profile sexual assault cases? Share your thoughts by giving us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. We also want to remind you this is a live show, so as always, we're not exactly sure what will be said, but considering the specific topic of this week's show, we recommend you decide whether or not the content's appropriate for you, especially if you have children with you. One of the things I wanted to ask Mary and Zach here, too, about those numbers we threw out there, 80 cases that Boone County prosecutor attempted in 2012, 20 of those resulting in a conviction. Is that a relatively common division of numbers there? What does that usually look like, see that many of initial cases actually, and then 36 taken and 20 that actually end up in convictions? How's that ratio compared to what you usually see?
I cannot tell you what those statistics are supposed to be. Mm-hmm. This School of Journalism previously looked at the number of rape prosecutions in every county in the state and compared it to the population in each county. And I don't remember what the proportions were, but the law school participated with the journalism students in doing that.
Actually, those numbers are a little better than average.
I would think so.
If you're looking across the nation in stats, really 3% of perpetrators of rape and sexual assault serve jail time. 3%. 54% go unreported. So if you're looking at the numbers out of Boone County, if you looked at, we had every victim of sexual assault and rape coming forward because they had that support, you could double those conviction numbers because over half of the people aren't even reporting and starting the process. And then with the winnowing down that goes through, which is understandable, police are going to have their discretion, prosecutors are going to have their discretion as well too. There's going to be those things that are in our justice system, and that is good. But those are going to actually improve our numbers when we see that. So across the board, we're seeing 3% of perpetrators actually receiving jail time. So if you knew there was a 3% chance of all the trauma you had to do as a victim to step forward and go through a case like this, and there's a 3% chance that you would see justice, that would make it very difficult to step forward. It'd be very difficult to stay with the process. It'd be very difficult to go in and suffer that trauma over and over and over again. So the question is, how can we support those individuals facing those difficult situations, and how can we make sure that perpetrators are more accountable for their behaviors?
So all these incidents we've talked about, Maryville we've talked about multiple times, is there a silver lining in there that the concept of victim blaming is now kind of a household word, that it's the conversations now happen about that concept? I mean, it seems like in the world of sexual assault victims, that's something that is intrinsic. You're going to understand that if you've been a victim of sexual assault. But I think to the outside world, it's maybe something that obviously we're talking about maybe more foreign. Do you think that these type of high profile incidents, Maryville, Steubenville, do you think that those may actually help this conversation along?
Definitely. I do.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. If you're looking at socio-ecological change, that starts at the individual. And when an individual learns and sees a situation differently than they did before and understand, I don't want that to occur, then individuals start changing their groups of friends and the people that they associate with. And then that in turn, the community's changing, whether that's a campus community, a high school community, a small community like Maryville, Albany, or any town out there, and bigger communities like metropolitan areas and states and institutions, and there's systematic change. But all that occurs when the individual decides enough is enough. I'm going to start seeing change out there. And how do I change? What do the things I do to change? Then that influences others to change, and you can start seeing that. These events have caused people to change. There's great work that's happening across the state and individual communities, and there is that information going out there. It's not enough.
You have those national groups. What is it called? Anonymous.com mm-hmm. or something? bringing a lot of pressure to bear on small communities like Steubenville or Maryville, demanding accountability for what actions are taken. I think those groups are very effective as well.
Mm-hmm. And the truth of it as well, too, even when we specifically talk about Maryville, I don't want people to think that that entire community is horrible. There's good people in Maryville that are appalled by the situation that's going on. Mm-hmm. And they're starting to speak out and show that support. And that's why, actually, the girls now are able to step forward because they felt the support in the community in Albany. And so there's great people in Maryville that support the local program that's up there. There's a great rape crisis center that's up there. But it's as we continue to build forward and everyone supporting each other as we move out, and that's where we can really see this change. And that change is occurring. We just need to continue pushing it forward. And like I said before, you can contact MCADSV. You can go to our website at mocadsv.org and really see it, the different ways that you can get involved.
Mm-hmm. All right. When you were earlier on, you threw out a comment about, you know, if everybody reported, is that ever a reachable goal, or is there we talked about how small the proportions are, but how long does something like that take to even get close to that? And what, you know, I mean, again, we're up against a very big problem here. We spent 50 minutes talking about it, right? But how big of an effort is this going to take? I mean, it's not a quick change, right?
No, it's not a quick change. And do I think we ever get to 100% people reporting? No. Mm-hmm. But right now, the facts on the table are that the reporting is dismal, and that is the community's fault, not the victim's fault. So until we start moving that and really start looking at norms change, then we'll see the numbers change. And that's where the community is responsible to protect the people that are inside the community. You're also responsible to teach the people that are around you as well, too.
And I think that's got to be systemic information education. It's got to start in the middle schools.
Yes.
And it's got to be in college and graduate school as well.
And it needs to be in businesses, and it needs to be in homes, and it needs to be in churches. It needs to be there. This is part of our society and part of American tradition that we are a sexualized nation that doesn't like to talk about sex. So we need to talk about that. We need to talk to everyone. And I've said it once, and I'll say it again. We need to talk to boys. We need to let them know what is appropriate, what's not, what you can, what you can't do. What is on the continuum of this? How are you exerting power over another individual? It's not acceptable to make a rape joke. It's not acceptable to put someone down. It's not acceptable to judge someone by the way they dress, the way they act. You really need to move forward and look at every kind of message that we're saying and make it systemic.
I actually want to bring in, we have a caller on the line. Murray from Columbia. Murray, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. Thank you very much for calling in today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay. So
I'm very interested in this topic.
Okay. Well, great. What do you want to share today?
Well, I wanted to share that our family has had a personal experience in this area. My 21-year-old granddaughter, who was a senior in a college on the East Coast, was shot and killed as she came out of a restaurant by her boyfriend, with whom she had broken up several weeks before. And the experience has totally, it's been a life-changing experience for our family. My daughter, her mother, is retired now from an administrative job with a college on the East Coast, and she is doing a considerable amount of speaking, most often at the request of prosecuting attorneys, groups, and other government agencies. To various kinds of groups. Like this week, she'll be speaking to a group of young women and their mothers from a lower economic area of the city, and she will be speaking along with a survivor. My daughter felt it was good to have the viewpoint of not only of what horrible thing had happened, but then to have the viewpoint of someone who was able to survive. But my daughter has also worked with the Red Flag campaign, which I'm sure you're aware of, and she is very impressed with what the cities in that area, the Norfolk, Virginia Beach, Chesapeake area, Suffolk, are doing to try to have a lot of educational programs.
Yeah, thank you very much for sharing that, Murray. Yeah, and I mean, the idea of that education after the fact, I mean, that probably is where we see a lot of advocates coming from, right?
You know? Yeah, sexual assault is just one behavior in a continuum of domestic violence. And to effectively educate people, the education needs to be directed towards domestic and sexual violence, and it does need to start in middle school. It does need to be continued in high school. It does need to be in college. We also need to recognize that one-third of the women killed in this country are killed by their domestic partner or former partner, as in the case of this poor young woman. And we need to start recognizing the seriousness of this and to start conveying it. There are lethality indices now. You can look at the constellation of behaviors of domestic violence and choose several, because those are the ones most linked with ultimate domestic homicide. Rape is one of them. Stalking is one of them. Use of alcohol is one of them. Domestic violence using weapons is one of them. There are about six or seven that are most highly associated with domestic homicide. We need to be teaching that to our college students. They need to know it. They need to know that if they are coerced into sex, if someone hits them with a weapon, if someone hits them when they're drunk, if someone stalks them, those are the behaviors associated with their ultimate demise, with their getting killed.
Wow, yeah. And so, yeah, it really is. The stakes are already high, but this is
beyond that,
right?
Yeah. Yes. A third of women in this country are killed by their domestic partner.
Right.
You know, we talk about girls, don't walk near the park, be careful about this or that, but their greatest danger is right in their own home or in their relationships with other romantic partners.
And we mentioned that too, on not talking about those larger domestic assaults, but sexual assaults too. It usually is someone you know, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And so it's not just someone lurking in the bushes or something.
Yeah, it's not the stranger in the bushes.
Right.
No. Right, right. Yeah, so, and Mary, I guess, I know that we actually, it took us to a good point, because this is really one of your areas of research too. I mean, what else have you found in working at the domestic violence clinic as well with these women in these situations? I mean, is it tough to make that leap out of those relationships? I mean, it has to be, yes?
It is. It's very difficult, partially because a phenomenon called separation assault, when a victim actually leaves a violent relationship, that's the point at which the abuser feels his or her control, domination is most threatened. And they are more likely to actually assault and kill the victim when she or he tries to get out of the relationship. So safety planning is an important feature. And then in terms of permanently making that break, most victims try to leave a violent relationship six or seven times before they finally effectuate a permanent separation. And in order to really make a permanent separation, in my clinic anyway, we have found that action plans are essential. Helping women, particularly women victims, attain economic and emotional independence is critical to actually getting out of a violent relationship.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we actually have for today's intersection. We'll stop it there for today. But thanks so much to our guest, Zach Wilson, with the Missouri Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, Mary Beck, the director of the MU Domestic Violence Clinic and a clinical professor of law, and Samantha Sunny, a former reporter at the Columbia Missourian. And thanks to our caller, Morel from Columbia. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is a broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersection is produced by Raymond Tungekar, Casey Morel, Janet Saidi, and Ruben Stern. Travis McMillan's our technical director, with production assistance from Caleb Hoke and Andrew Yost. Trevor Harris is our audio producer. I'm Ryan Fumiller. Thanks for joining us, and have a great week.